Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Hello, Jim and Austin. We've talked about a lot of different countries, and I thought what it'd be interesting to do is talk about the United States like we talk about some of the other countries and what the issues are in the United States.
Well, look, Dan, I think our biggest problems are economic right now, and there's all kinds of multiple filaments in running through. When you say that economics, it runs from research and development and education issues onto encouraging investment in new ideas or discouraging it, as well as some of the approaches that we have had to dealing with the recession, with massive government intervention, the answer, what were the alternatives, where do we go from now, and all of this ultimately feeds back into leadership, immigration issue, border issues. All that deals with leadership issues as well. So when we come down to saying the specificity of a problem, the United States is grappling with a great deal of a number of economic challenges and economic readjustment. That said, I would rather have America's problems than anyone else's, which is not typically what I see in the mainstream media.
The other problem we have is some big ones that we don't even acknowledge. Perhaps the biggest one, which is very pertinent today, is healthcare and our approach to it. I studied this about a decade or so ago when I did a book on the millennium. Everybody had to do a millennium book back then. And I studied the way medical care is handled in other Western countries, which have the same outcomes but spend half or less than we do. The problem, it turned out, after digging around a little bit, is that America has, since colonial times, developed this habit, custom, whatever you want to call it, of aggressive medical care. In other words, too much ain't enough. Now, this was not a big problem, except for like George Washington, who was, some say, was bled to death because bleeding was a big cure back in those days. And as we know now, and many people could figure out back then, you know, taking too much blood out of somebody doesn't do them any good. But when modern medicine, chemical medicine, came about, in the 30s and 40s, especially with the introduction of antibiotics, and then a flood of other products, you know, basically the result of a century of unending progress in chemistry and in biology, we got a lot of cures that we couldn't afford, or that most people couldn't afford. But we take it for granted as Americans that everybody deserves everything, but we can't afford it. Now, some people during the medical debate have pointed that out. The Republicans jumped on it and talked about death panels. But if you look at the way universal health care is handled in other countries, and it's all handled a little differently. That's something else that wasn't brought out enough. Many countries, Germany and France, have come up with different solutions to problems we're having. But the big problem that none of them have is this attitude of we're all entitled to everything, and we can't afford everything.
Right. It's almost like, you know, the way I compare it to is as if everyone wanted the latest DVD player and felt like they were entitled to it with all the, you know, bells and whistles, that it would be a problem instead of letting it actually trickle down, where as the people buy the expensive DVDs, it pushes down the price, and eventually everyone can afford it.
Yes, but that brings up another problem that was discussed. With DVDs and consumer electronics, you have to pay for it.
Right.
With medical care, you don't pay for it directly. It's a tax, whether it's insurance that your employer pays for, or, you know, Medicare or Medicaid or whatever. You do not feel the pain when you ask for too much.
Right.
There are no restraints on your demands. And the media loves
there's
that.
Also, there's also, besides the health issues or life and death issues, and the intrusion on the individual being able to make certain decisions for him or herself and with their doctor. And that is a component of it that changes it from just a purely, metaphorical comparison to DVD player. But then look, the other things that Jim comes back from there discussing the medical issue, it comes back to economics. And then the U.S. economic readjustment, not just out of the recession, but to the realities and options, and really that's one of the things Jim was mentioning there, the medical option in this case, that the 21st century presents. There are a lot of things that we can do. They're expensive. Are we going to try to do them all? Or are we going to leave it some of the choice to private sector and individuals if they're going to be able, if they're going to carry the economic burden upon themselves, or is the public going to pay for it? And that's the issue. Leadership is the art element of how that's going to be resolved, and I think America has a continuing, I won't say crisis, but a leadership deficit.
Well, nobody will even mention it. I mean, it's the ultimate hot potato. Nobody wants to even touch it. I mean, you can do simple things, for example, like making, if you're going to have universal medical care, which people are determined to have, make it payable directly from individuals by a tax. In other words, you have your FICA, you have your various taxes, well, medical. And so people will see every year, this is what we're paying. Of course, the problem is half the people in the country don't pay any taxes at all, which is another problem. The entire tax system, is a bit of a problem because politicians have an incentive to hide taxes as much as possible. Greece isn't the only
one. They don't
want
to be held responsible. That's the leadership deficit. They don't want to be held responsible.
Well, they don't want people to feel the pain. Or they don't want people to associate the pain with political decisions.
With them, or associate the pain
exactly.
With them. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's why they'll
implement programs that the pain won't be felt until they're long out of office and collecting their big tax pension.
Right. Now, one of the things that I think is going on is that, or has happened to America over the last 50 years, is that if we go back to our parents' day or our grandparents' day or our great-grandparents' day, they saw themselves as, well, the United States has to compete. We've got to become the best. Now we're on top, and it's like we don't feel that need anymore, and we don't realize that we're in these quote unquote economic wars with some of the other large economies out there.
Well, that's where our custom of accepting immigrants still, unlike most other countries in the world, has done us good, because immigrants always come in, almost always come in from lower economic situations. And they look at America with basically we still encourage entrepreneurship and make it easier than, again, in most other countries to start a business and to prosper. They see that and they just go wild. That'll usually only last one or two generations. But it basically gives us an edge. An edge that we don't often mention. But just look at the names or look at the faces of many of the, latest, entrepreneurial billionaires. They're all people who are first or second generation. And the reason they're doing it is because that's how they were brought up, hungry. But,
right.
The kids, the grandkids aren't so hungry. And that's a big advantage that, unfortunately, will not save us forever, because as has been pointed out, when you have the majority of the population not thinking that way anymore, then you start to lose that edge. It becomes harder for entrepreneurs. As a lot of small businessmen will tell you, in states like New York or Massachusetts and what have you, they kill entrepreneurs. It's very tough to start a business or to keep a business going. And then they yell at you when you leave for some other state where the tax situation is not so vexing that you're deserting them. Well, what do you expect?
Well,
yeah.
Look, Jim has just in his answer there, describe what I mean about policies that either encourage investment, encourage wealth creation, encourage experimentation, economic experimentation, or discourage it. And then my first answer to your original question on this is that those are part and parcel of our economic readjustment issues that we face. And again, those also come into leadership. I guess that's going to be my theme for the day on it. But Jim just described something that happens really at the tactical level of economics. The small business person in Massachusetts who says, I'm sorry, I've had it. I'm on my way now to Texas, on my way to New Mexico. I'm going to Nevada or the like. Because,
or Utah.
yeah. Utah. Well, potentially Utah, even Florida. You know, the thing is that we've got a political structure that rewards that kind of economic experimentation, which requires a great deal of sweat equity instead of penalizing. And that's part of what we are seeing going on, really. I would say that this issue it's become more acute and more self-evident, Dan. But this has been an issue that has been going on really since the early 1970s, and it's a major issue in U.S. elections. It's rarely dealt with squarely as it's being dealt with now, as the recession revealed. The rewards of having a tax system or a political structure that encourages investment and rewards economic success. And that's the small businessman that Jim described sees that, and he picks up and moves from a place that penalizes to a place that is either neutral or encourages. So.
Well, that brings up another, advantage we do have with a federal system with 50 states. You have 50 different governments determining the economic climate, for entrepreneurs. So now you have this huge exodus out of California, which for decades was living in Fat City, and the politicians went crazy. They were throwing the money and jobs around. And, of course, this is always a problem with governments trashing the economy. They use their ability to tax to create patronage armies. In other words, to put a lot of people who will vote for them on the payroll. That's one thing that killed Greece. Spain also has a problem. All throughout South America, it's a huge problem. I mean, countries have, in the past, gone bankrupt again and again because of this. And in America, we don't have the entire country going bankrupt, but we have a few states heading in that direction, New York being one of them. And that serves as a wake-up call for the other states. They sit around and say, ooh, do we want to be California? Do we want to be New York? They're feeling pain.
Yeah, I know, and this has probably happened in Texas, Austin, is I know here in Utah, even though we were in a better shape than most states, everybody reined back this year on the spending and looked at the example of California and some of the other states and said, whoa, we don't want to end up there.
Well, look, Jim just did.
And it's not over yet. I mean, New York State, for example, is still trying to deal with a $6 billion shortfall, and none of those pork fed politicians up there are willing to pull the trigger.
Right.
So we're going to have a little Greece right here in New York State. and it's pathetic. I mean, I, a lifelong resident of New York State, I'm very familiar with the, especially at the state level, we have the state and the city creates most of the wealth, the state spends it. And there's always been that push and pull between state and city, but the city went through its apotheosis, its ring of fire in the 1970s, and now are by law they have to balance the budget. And of course you have the richest man in the city, and well, I don't know if he's the richest in the city, but one of the richest men. You have a billionaire running the city, and believe me, I guess this gets out into the nationwide press. He tells it like it is, whether it's popular or not. He understands business is business, and running a country, a city, whatever, is a business. If you spend more than you're taking in, it's eventually going to bite you in the rear end.
Let me make a point out of this, because this a couple of things that Jim and I have said here actually cue some of our listeners on how we do this when we're looking at foreign situations or foreign policy situations. Jim hit the evident truth of the U.S. system. It's a federal system that allows for alternatives within the nation state. Other nations that are completely centrally planned or lack that kind of federalism have straitjacketed themselves in terms of economic experimentation or legal experimentation. Unfortunately, some of our politicians look to some of these states and say, hey, they're centrally planned, they got it done, they passed it, and now, you know, it's uniform, and claim that there are advantages out of that. For certain kinds of things, the uniformity may, if you hit the answer correctly, you may prosper. But the U.S. system allows for experimentation. We'd compare that to, again, a centrally planned economy or the like. But here's something else, too. Issues of corruption. Now, it's something we write about on Strategy Page all the time. You read it when Jim's writing on something about economic, or when I'm writing on all these places in Africa or the Balkans or what's going on in Russia or some of these things like that. Centrally planned economies, well, not just central planning itself, magnifies the effects of corruption. Because all it has to be, and some of this doesn't, I don't necessarily mean criminal corruption, but let's just call it information corruption. You've limited yourself to a certain decision-making group. Their opinions are the ones that affect the entire economic or the entire political state, and you have excluded, really, which is one of the gifts of grand gifts of economics, is individual decision-making based on best choices. So what you see working through so many places, and here I'm not just talking about Africa on this, but I've got several of the African states in mind when I say it, is the central government does the planning, and the two or three corrupted ministers who are kicking contracts in XYZ areas, suddenly they have really degraded opportunity for economic expansion or economic growth because of their total control and their criminal activity. In the U.S., we've got a justice system that does function to decrease, doesn't eliminate, to decrease corruption, and then we have the 50 states as experiments where you can try some of these ideas, and then you can compare their results. And that's another way of limiting the effects of corruption through a centrally planned state.
Well, you're seeing this to a certain extent in Europe now. Greece has its problems, big problems. But many Greeks are looking at the other countries in the European Union. I mean, Europe is not a single state, but it is a federation, a fairly close federation, more so than in the past, of sovereign countries. But a lot of Greeks are saying, you know, I think the problem might be us. It's obviously the politicians and the media they control are pushing, you know, the fact that, you know, the idea that it's the other countries in the European Union that are hurting for Greece. But, you know, Greece is basically the author of its own misfortunes. And a lot of Greeks are not only, you know, realizing that, but they're starting to, you know, get out there and say, hey, you know, let's clean up our own house, because that's where the problem is.
All right. Now, one of the interesting things is as you guys have gone through with Quick and Dirty Guide to War and like that, we look at some of these other nations. Let's take one that people often try to say, well, we should be more like Sweden. And we don't realize that Sweden really is only 8 million people. I mean, it's the size of Kansas, and it's very homogeneous. And so when you try to do a one-to-one comparison, it doesn't really come across well.
No, and of course, Sweden and all the Nordic countries have several things in common. You've already pointed out they're homogeneous, although less so these days. They've let a lot of, you know, foreigners in the last 20 years, and that's created problems they didn't think existed except in the United States.
Right.
But they also have an advantage in that they have terrible winters up there. Winters have an amazing effect on economics. They make you focus. Now, in some countries like, you know, Russia, it's been somewhat perverted in that the Russians can get a lot done in a short period of time, you know, when their backs are to the wall. And of course, your backs are against the wall every time winter rolls around. But at the same time, Russia created a centralized government with the, you know, with the planned economy, which was all wrong, which they now realize. But they also, in the process, didn't do anything about corruption, which existed when the Tsar was around, and it only got worse when the communists came along. And now they have this corruption problem, which Putin, you know, a man of the Soviet period, has actually done a lot to eliminate, but it's pervasive. There's a lot of it. So even if you have, you know, cultural and climactic, so to speak, you know, advantages, to spur you into, you know, basically doing what's good for everybody, if you are stuck with old habits that are very bad, you basically got to get rid of them or die. And this is what Russia is facing now. You know, until a couple of years ago, their population was declining. People were dying faster and not enough were getting born. Now they've started to turn that around. You know, the population is still shrinking. But they realized they had a problem and they're addressing it. And of course that brings up the ultimate problem. None of these things can be fixed by the flip of a switch. They all take long solutions, and nobody likes a solution that's going to take years and years of hard work. Everybody wants something that's going to be instantaneous, and it doesn't work that way.
Right.
Dan, and for looking for countries as models for the U.S., I kind of flip it over. And here, and I guess I'm going to sound like an American universalist. I don't mean to sound that at this particular moment. The U.S. is really a unique situation. It's polyethnic. It is also, whether we you like it or not, polyglot. It is. It's because of the immigration. Jim and I have hit on some of these demographic issues as well. It is federal. It's experimental in a way that there are other countries that have this neck, Canada to a degree, but the U.S. has some unique traits that don't get considered in a lot of the soundbite politics that are practiced. Maybe they're going to be practiced anyway. Everything's going to be reduced to a bumper sticker in order to attract a voter. But the thing is that looking for models and saying, hey, we want to import the Swedish medical system, you know, the medical care system in Sweden to the U.S., again, you are taking, as you said, you've got a limited number of people, limited geographic space, different kind of traditions, and, you know, it might be appropriate, could be appropriate, to one state. You could experiment with it on one single state level. But the U.S. has some uniqueness that rarely, you know, you look at the critics, look at the mistakes, and look at the problems U.S. has instead of looking at the way it goes around, it goes about solving those problems and seeing some of the, again, the inclination towards experimentation as being the strength that it is. And that's I'm not saying anything that's new. I just think that this is something that gets neglected. I don't really see any working national medical care options that are applicable to the entire United States. And you said they're Canadian critics of their own system, and I happen to be, and I'm not going to waste time on this, but I happen to know of many of the issues that the Swedes have with their own medical care system. After a certain age, it becomes hard to get medical care. And I know that both anecdotally and statistically.
Right. I've experienced the Nordic system, and so I know a little bit about it, and it's not all what they crack it up to be. The one thing I
mentioned that just as one thing. The big point out of what I said was that you got to look at the U.S. for the unique system that it is in many ways. It is.
Yeah. The one thing I'd like to address before we wrap up here, gentlemen, is one of the things that has me concerned about the U.S. right now is the state of our military and where we are at, specifically with the Army. I think the Air Force and the Navy are doing better, but the Army personnel have been run through the meat grinder over the last 7 years and the effects that has had on them.
Let me cover that a lot. the PTSD and the stress. The Army's going to be suffering from this for a long time, as is the United States. You know, the Veterans Administration is being overrun with a lot of the wounded, not just, you know, PTSD, but, you know, physical infirmities. And it's only going to get worse, because one of the downside of much improved medical care, which cut the death rate in combat, you know, by 2/3 compared to Vietnam and World War II, basically a lot of those guys who would have been killed in past wars are now very badly banged up, and they require a lot of care. It's hard on them, obviously, and it's expensive for the rest of us. And of course, the Army has a lot of people who are still on active duty or in the reserves. Are suffering from, you know, the PTSD, which has a tendency to blow up, you know, years later. So this, the damage done to the Army is going to be felt, you know, for a decade or more. And there's not much, you know, can be done except, you know, just, you know, belly up and pay for it.
Right.
Oscar? I agree with everything Jim said on that. And that's well said. I do think they, I know, because I heard of my first briefing on this about 5 years ago, 2005, about changing the personnel tempo of deployments, spreading it out, and giving soldiers more downtime, but it is stability and family time is what it amounts to. Because we have an older force with more dependents, and we have lots of husband and wife, soldier teams, and that's a real change from, even 25, 30 years ago, and it's important for overall morale, and that's recognized. Again, let's pick up something else that we said earlier. Solving some of these things with the large organizations, such as the military, much less the entire country, takes some time. But I think what Jim had to say about the PTSD and medical stuff is absolutely right on. And that's something we say regularly when we provide our opinions on strategy pay.
Right.
I say so.
And I don't think the general public realizes that even some of these reserve guys are on their third and fourth deployments, either to Iraq or Afghanistan.
I know that for a fact.
Yeah.
Dan, I'm going to have to ring off here.
Okay.
All right.
Well, Jim, can you think of anything else that's facing the United States at this point?
Militarily, there are no major problems. I mean, we're the top dog. Terrorism is still the big threat because it can come out of anywhere. It's not attached to a country. Indeed, this is one of the big reasons why much is made of Iran. Because Iran and its puppet Syria are one of the two big refuges of terrorism. A lot of them were hanging out in Pakistan, but we finally got the Pakistanis, you know, to act on that. But one place where the terrorists can always find, you know, a place to, you know, hide out and recuperate are Syria and Iran. And at the same time, Iran is trying to get nuclear weapons. And there are a lot of people in Washington who are very, you know, anxious about this, because the combination of nuclear material, whether it's in a bomb or not, and a lot of terrorists running loose, you know, without any, you know, supervision, is a scary thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a big danger. It's going to destroy us all danger, but it's basically going to make life very unpleasant for whoever gets hit with a dirty bomb or just more bombs, because there are places where terrorists can hang out and plot these atrocities.
Do you think that there's going to be any established connections between the terrorists and the narco lords, the crime lords down in Mexico and South America?
Not directly. What we have detected is that people smugglers from the Middle East have been making deals with the smugglers in Mexico and in Latin America. Venezuela, for example. There was an arrest recently where they found an American had made a deal with a Cuban diplomat, in the Middle East to basically provide visas to Cuba, and then from Cuba they received the paperwork to allow them to fly on to Venezuela, and from there they could make their way to Mexico and then get smuggled into the United States. Now, these, as far as can be told, were economic refugees, not terrorists, but, you know, if a terrorist wants to slip one of their people in, they may already have. What's to stop them? Nothing.
Right.
The mechanism is already there. That's why Venezuela is a big deal. I mean, basically, Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, you know, is comical in the way he, you know, talks about, oh, America's going to invade us, America this, America that. We need a leftist, you know, socialist republic dominating all of Latin America, or at least the northern part where I am. You know, you can laugh at that, but he's lending serious, you know, assistance to countries like Iran and letting them do pretty much whatever they want. He also allows the drug lords to move their drugs out. Now, countries like Iran, and to a lesser extent Syria, have big problems with drugs. Iran is fighting a war and has been fighting a war for years on their Afghan border, trying to keep the opium and the heroin out, because they have over 2 million, possibly over 3 million addicts, which is a big problem. And, of course, they are a theocracy, country run by clerics, and drugs are a no-no. Not as bad as alcohol and, you know, and tank tops, but still something that to be discouraged, because it does harm, a lot of harm. Creates, you know, criminals, ruins, you know, people's, you know, careers and lives, breaks up families, you know, the usual routine. We experience it here. But they're not used to that much of it there, but they're right next to Heroin Central. So they are not directly involved in, you know, dealing with the drug wars. They're actually fighting against it. But a lot of other countries that aren't in the front line, don't have a huge, you know, domestic drug problem, they're more than happy to say, well, yeah, well, if these low lives will help us, you know, we'll do business with them. Al-Qaeda, for example, has been for the last 6 months or a year, been providing armed guards for convoys bringing cocaine up from, you know, Guinea-Bissau up to the Mediterranean coast where it can be smuggled into Europe. They're doing it for the money, for the cause.
Right.
The ends justify the means. That's what you have to worry about when it comes to, you know, drug gangs and, you know, criminals in general. They'll do it for the buck.
Right. Well, we've reached our time limit here, Jim. So it sounds like if we wrap back to the beginning that still, you know, the United States' biggest problem is economic, and if we don't get our economic house in order, we're going to be suffering for decades, really.
Yeah. We have met the enemy, and it is us.
It is us. That is true. All right. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.